right, we're continuing the interview with Harry Conger on January 17th, 2000 in Walnut Creek. Okay?
So, anyhow, they came to us with that offer, that suggestion, and we thought, well, God, here's a chance to get in on a major sulfur discovery. And so we agreed to do that. And so as the bidding got down to the final days when we turn in our bids for these leases, Freeport calls up Texas Gulf, because Freeport didn't even know we were interested in this. Freeport called up Texas Gulf and said, look, no sense us batting ourselves over the head with each other and these things. Why don't we form a consortium and we'll bid on these jointly, these leases. So Freeport made that offer to Texas Gulf, and Texas Gulf got a hold of us and said, well, you know, that sort of makes sense to us. It further spreads the risk. Why don't we do that? So we said, okay, this wasn't our line of work anyhow. So it became a three-party partnership between Freeport, Texas Gulf, and ourselves. Well, so we bid on the leases, and we won all of the ones we wanted to. We were successful. We must have gotten five leases. And these sulfur deposits form on the top of these salt domes. And salt domes are known because not only geophysics, but the oil companies have been drilling around these salt domes for oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico. And salt domes make a great trap for oil and gas because they're just pillows of salt that will come from very deep in the seafloor up through these layers of sediment to very near the surface. And so as the salt domes come up through these various sedimentary beds, they tilt the beds upwards a little bit. And so oil and gas that is driven by seawater that gets into these various beds that host the hydrocarbons, the seawater pushes the lighter oil and gas up, dip, until they run into these salt domes, which are impervious. So they're traps. They're natural hydrocarbon traps, these salt domes. So the oil and gas companies for years have been drilling around the edges of these salt domes. They never drill the top of a salt dome because they're not a trap. So here are these salt domes sitting out there with these drill rigs all around them, where the oil and gas companies have been drilling for oil and gas. So they're well, the domes are well known, but nobody ever drills on the top of them because there's no oil and gas there. So anyhow, we won at least five leases. I just forget now how many, but we were successful on the ones we wanted. And so we started drilling. We picked the most prospective one first. And I think Freeport must have been 50% of all of these. They bid the most. They were the major partner. And Texas Gulf was probably 25%. We were like 15% interest in these leases. So anyhow, drilled the first one, nobody home. I think drilled the second one, nobody home. Moved to the third one, and lo and behold, Texas Gulf, the people with whom we were first partnering with, they had since been acquired by the French. So it was now a French company, and the French wouldn't give them money right then to drill the third dome, so they had to pass on it. Lo and behold, we hit the granddaddy. Mm-hmm. We hit a very, very rich sulfur deposit. And lo and behold, overlying the sulfur deposit, which never happens, was an oil reservoir on top of it. It never happens. Oil is always on the sides of these salt domes. Not this time. It was on top of it, on top of the salt dome and the sulfur deposit. So you know, our cup runneth over here. We've not only found this rich sulfur deposit, it's got oil on top of it, which we get to enjoy the benefit from. So that, and the irony was that our original partner opted out because their French parent wouldn't give them the money to drill that lease. So as it turns out, this all looked terrific because the projection for the sulfur market was such that within 5 years' time there would be a real shortage of sulfur, elemental sulfur, and so this new mine would be coming on stream just in time to enjoy that. And at the time when we made the discovery, the sulfur price was probably $120 a ton or something like that, even then. But it was going to go up from that in 5 years' time. The projections, everybody's government's projection, Freeport's projection, Texas Gulf's projection, everybody said that. And so we thought, gee, how lucky we get to produce this oil and gas, or oil primarily. And then after, and the decision was made to take the oil off first, so that as we took the sulfur out, the subsidence wouldn't fracture the horizon that's holding the oil in that bed. And so the plan was to take the oil out first, primarily all of it, and then mine the sulfur, because you can start the oil production immediately, and it'd take a couple of years to build a plant and everything to extract the sulfur by the frash processors. Steam injection to melt the sulfur and airlift the molten sulfur out of the ground and into barges. So at any rate, we, not being in the sulfur business, engaged Freeport, who was in the sulfur business, to be our agent and market our share of the production. And at $120 a ton, or anything more than that, it would have been a very lucrative thing for us. Trouble was, by the time the thing got in production, the sulfur price had dropped. And much like the gold price, stayed and has stayed at between $60 and $70 a ton, not $120 a ton going north. And so that was our unfortunate experience. And we lost money probably every year that the mine has operated, or broke even, just about broke even. On a cash basis, I think we were probably always about even, but certainly on a total cost basis, we lost not a great amount of money, but lost money. And the sulfur price never came back. I think in the last 2 years, the company has written off our investment in that, because at $60 and $70 a ton with the agency fee we had to pay Freeport, we just couldn't recover our investment. There was no way to do it. And nobody was projecting that the sulfur price was going to do anything but stay at $60 or $70 a ton. So that was written off. We had invested about $150 million, our share of the development of the property. Fortunately, there was the oil production, which we hadn't reckoned on. So that kept our losses to just, on a cash basis, I think we were about break even, but kept us from losing a lot more money. Mm-hmm. But the remaining investment in the property was written off about 2 years ago, and I forget how much. It was maybe $50 or $60 million by that time that had to be written off. So it wonderful discovery, great ore body, not our business, should have stayed with our business, absolutely. But probably the only major ore body we were involved in as a grassroots discovery. And it didn't turn out to be profitable. Mm-hmm. So that, I think one thing we wanted to talk a little bit about was listing on foreign exchanges.
Yes, but I had another question before then. We're talking about your plans and for this exploration project and so on. And then with Corona, you also acquired a new person.
Yes.
Peter Steen.
Yeah, well, quite a few people. We kept
right,
quite a few of their
Peter
people.
Came in as your president.
Peter came in as president.
And I was wondering how that affected the organization and your philosophy and so on.
That had a direct effect on our organization. When we acquired Corona, it was a Canadian company with two properties. Actually, there were three properties. There was the nickel plate mine that was operating that they had. A very marginal mine.
Was that nickel?
No, it was gold.
Gold.
But the name of the mine was the nickel plate.
Okay.
And I don't recall how it got its name. Mm-hmm. But it was in British Columbia in a beautiful spot near Penticton. But that mine, while they managed it, really was not profitable for them. They had sold gold forward for that mine, and because the gold price kept falling, they made money on the hedging, but the mine itself wasn't making money on a standalone basis. But the two mines that were operating, they did not manage either of them, but they were the two large Hemlo mines that were very low cost, high volume, and very profitable for Corona. And they had this new mine in British Columbia, the Eskay Creek mine. So it was a Canadian company headquartered in Vancouver. And when we acquired the company, I had my Felmon experience behind me now, having acquired that company and having the difficulty with the management in that company, which we wanted to keep. And the way I handled that taught me that I sure wanted to do this acquisition differently as far as management was concerned. And what I did was ask Peter Steen, who was the CEO of, he was president CEO of Corona. I asked him to come to San Francisco as our chief operating officer and president. And I asked Jack Thompson to go to Canada to run the Canadian operations, because we had a Canadian company up there, which was a public company called Prime Resources.
Now you were
I
you
was
were
chairman.
President.
I was chairman and CEO.
Oh, was Jack already
CEO.
President?
No.
You were president.
I was chairman.
Chairman.
And CEO.
Yes.
And the 92. I think Bill Humphrey was president at that time. And COO.
He succeeded. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then when,
yes.
and Bill, I asked him, Bill to stay on. Bill should have retired then at 65. I asked him to stay on. This was after Dave Fagan left.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him to stay on and as president. And then when we acquired Corona, Bill retired and I put Peter in as president and COO, chief operating officer.
You were chairman and CEO.
CEO.
He came in as president
COO.
And COO.
And I asked Jack Thompson to go to Canada to run the Canadian public company, Prime Resources, that was the owner of Eskay Creek, as well as our Canadian subsidiary. What I'd learned before was don't leave the other guys in their old office doing their old stuff. Mix them up. Get some of our guys with them and some of their guys with us. And so that's so Peter came down and joined us in San Francisco, and Jack went up and took what had been Peter's job up there in Canada. So that did make some changes, and we kept quite a few of their senior people who are still with the company. Gil Leatley was one of their operating guys. Dave Pete was their controller. He came down and was controller for us. And their chief explorationist, Tony Ransom, came down and became our chief explorationist. So that, you know, it was really an integration of the two companies, but we mixed people up so that everybody had a chance to work in a new environment rather than how we used to do it, kind of thing. And that, I must say, in all modesty, that worked very well. It worked very well. And certainly that was a good thing for Jack to do, to actually go run a public company before he took over as Homestake's chief executive. And so that worked out, I think, very well.
And then at the same time, you were doing a lot of...
Well, back in that, to get to the point of sort of the road travel, the trips to Europe and so forth, that started in the 83-84 period, probably. The gold business by now was back in business. There were a lot of folks in it. A lot of new companies have started up, a lot of interest in Europe about gold investment. And so the only, in the early days, the only opportunity Europeans had to directly invest in gold properties was South Africans, because they were traded on the Swiss and London and the newer Frankfurt stock exchanges. There were a lot of invitations for We Homestake, which was an old line mining company that Europeans had invested in, particularly the Swiss people, but they had to do it through ADRs. They couldn't own our shares directly because we weren't listed in Switzerland. There was a lot of, not pressure, but they were anxious to have us list over there. And since we had
You said that the South Africans could invest directly?
No, the Europeans could own South African shares directly.
Okay, all right.
The Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
And Europeans have been gold appreciators forever. Mm-hmm. So
they had invested in South Africa
for
rather
years.
Than North America.
Yeah, okay. For years.
That was
where those mines
right.
sold much of
mm-hmm.
their stock.
Okay.
So at any rate, the Swiss really wanted us to list over there too, so that the Swiss could hold our shares directly through their own exchange and trade it freely. And they pointed out that over 15% of our stock was already held by the Swiss through ADRs, and so that...
I've forgotten, something drawing
rights. American drawing rights, yeah.
American drawing rights,
yeah.
Okay.
And so that, you know, that was a single biggest...
How did this come to you? How
well,
did
they
talk to you?
The banks, UBS was the most aggressive one.
They had a branch in San Francisco.
Oh yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And so, you know, they would come and say, look, you got a list over there. We look at all these people we have in our list, our banking list, for you, for your shares. We do this business for them. So why don't you list over there and make it so much easier for them? And besides, gold business is back in business again. Everybody's interested in gold. So that was persuasive, and so we did that. We listed in the Swiss exchange first, both in Geneva, Zurich, and Basel.
How do you go about this? What do you do?
Well, it's a bunch of paper. First of all, you got to pay money to do it, which is one reason you don't just run out and list in these other exchanges. Then there's all kinds of documentation that has to be executed for the listing, and then you have requirements for those exchanges, just like we do for the New York Stock Exchange. You got to print reports, either annual or quarterly, and they had to be in some language. So you have all of those things that you have to comply with the list on these various exchanges. Now, fortunately, the ones we listed on, we didn't have a language. We didn't have to print our reports in anything but English, because Europe is an English-speaking continent. And so that was from a business standpoint. And so that was okay. Japan, for years, tried to get us a list over there, and we didn't do it because we'd have to put everything in Japanese, and we just didn't see the market there. But that wasn't true in Europe. There was an appetite for our shares and other gold shares. And so we listed first on the Swiss exchange, and then a year or two later on the Frankfurt exchange, and then either that year or the next year on the London exchange. We listed on those three exchanges. During the middle 80s, there was a lot of interest in our stock, and it got a lot of trading on those exchanges. For, I think it was 3 years, we remained on the tote board in the Frankfurt exchange. The foreign stocks that trade at least, I forget what the number was, but 15% of their stock or something like that listed, if it traded on the market in a certain period of time, they kept you up on the tote board, which was just all the foreign stocks, IBM and General Motors and all of those, on this board. And then all of the domestic stocks were handled differently. It was just the foreign stocks were on this board. And you had to have a certain turnover in your stocks every quarter, every year, to stay up there. So for the first 3 years, we were up there with General Motors and IBM and all those people. But then, as gold kept going down and down, and interest started to wane in gold investment, we came off that. And so then the value of maintaining that listing began to diminish. And in London, we never did trade much. So, what we thought we saw there wasn't there. And so that turned out to be a listing that was not beneficial.
But you must have had a lot of fun.
Well, and you asked what happens. Well, finally, after you've done all of the paperwork and everything, and obviously I didn't do any of that. I didn't do any of the work, but our people did. Wayne Kirk and Wayne Gene Elam, at that time it would have been Dick Stumbo and Doug Drumright before him, as CFOs, did all of the work. They and their people did all the work, but finally, when all of that work is done, then sure enough, you go over to Geneva or Zurich or Basel, and you have a signing ceremony where I had to sign, I forget how many copies of these documents for all of the agencies and so forth in each of the countries. Then a big luncheon afterwards, and then a chance to speak to the group and tell them about the company and all of that stuff. And it's heady stuff, and it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun to do. You're meeting the top people in finance and business in these countries. So It is fun, and I'd not be telling the truth if I didn't say it wasn't fun to do that.
Ellis enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it, yeah, yeah. I did enjoy it.
And Phyllis.
And she...
She was in
Well, yes, it depends on what the, you know, the length of the stay. She never went with me if I was just going to be gone for a day or so, because it was so expensive for her to come.
Mm-hmm.
But on others that, you know, would be extended for 2 or 3 or 4 days, yeah, she used to come along mm-hmm. doing, and she enjoyed it too. Yeah,
I remember that she did.
Yeah, it was great fun for both of us. These two little kids out there with all these folks. So it was a lot of fun to do, and that went on in each of the exchanges, for the listing and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then that required a follow up every year. Now you have a shareholding group in each of these jurisdictions, and they expect to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to just hear from you when things are going great. They don't need you when things are going great.
Mm-hmm.
They're when they really want to hear from you is when things aren't going so well. And so we made it a point and a commitment to ourselves that, okay, we will go each year to each of these countries and make a presentation and do it same time every year, so it doesn't look like
to
we're
whom?
To investors, and it's always sponsored at each of these in each of these countries. We had a country sponsor. It was UBS in Switzerland. It was Deutsche Bank in Germany, and I'm forgetting which of the mining houses in England sponsored us. I forget just now. But so they would arrange our tours over there. They would send out the invitation list to all the analysts and investors, large investors, fund managers and investment banks and so forth. They would invite them to a luncheon, then we would make a presentation to them on what's happened in the last year and what we're anticipating next year. And so we did that every year in each of those jurisdictions, each of those countries. So that required trips over there to do that. Now, the other benefit to that was that Europe was a market for financing mining ventures. And so we kept a line of credit all of these years with a consortium of banks that would then want us to come over, because many of them were European banks or Canadian banks, one or two Australian banks, but they'd want us to come over and make presentations to people they wanted to invite to a luncheon, because they hoped that we would have a project that would draw on this line of credit, and then they could make money that way. But by us continuing to show up, gave them an opportunity to show off what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this second audience for our presentations in Europe, mm-hmm. and in Canada and in Australia. And that was the banks that were part of our line of credit,
mm-hmm.
When we needed to either acquire something or develop a new property or so forth. So there were the two reasons to make
mm-hmm.
these trips and presentations in these various countries. So,
I was wondering also about two things, the German Baron and your connection mm-hmm. with South Africa.
Okay, the Baron, I'll make very brief because you'll be picking that up in time to come.
Mm-hmm.
Jack will have the story on that. Jack, I've not met him. Jack
well,
has.
Let's say who he is.
Baron von Finck.
His connection with Homestead.
Well, he's a very wealthy German industrialist that has for years invested in various companies and has taken a very active interest in the companies, not to my knowledge in a management sense, but certainly in a very aware investor sense. A very good businessman understands the business that he is invested in, and therefore with one or two seats on the boards of these companies that he invests in, he is able to see how the company's progressing, have input into the company's policies and programs, and take that kind of an active posture in his investments.
You didn't meet him at this time?
I have not met him. Jack has met him. He's been to his home. He's met him in other venues. To this point, he and the Baron have a good relationship. At this point, I think the investment has been nothing but positive, even though the company's stock right now is not doing well at all.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it has nothing to do with the Baron. But at any rate, that relationship is a new one, to have somebody with that large a holding who wanted even a larger holding and has not yet taken a larger holding. We've never had that before. The largest holding before was Case Pomeroy, Hadley Case's company, that had a 12% holding in the company. And Hadley, of course, went on our board, as I mentioned in our earlier discussions, and was a very positive influence on my thinking and the board's thinking. And that worked out wonderfully well, and hopefully Baron von Fink's relationship will work out that well for the current management.
This was not a direct result of your listing on the Frankfurt Exchange, though.
No. This is much later. In fact, we've unlisted from that exchange, and so this is way after that.
Right.
Yeah, way after that.
Well, I thought maybe
no
that
connection.
Seeds
no,
in that.
No.
No.
No
okay.
connection.
All right. I had just thought perhaps that was a direct outcome of that.
No. Okay. Yeah, those are entirely separate issues. So I think that really covers the exchanges and why we were on them and the benefit we did get and thought we were going to get from that. Mm-hmm. So might just run down sort of a laundry list of some things, unless you had want to direct.
No, that's fine. I'd like to take. Yeah, we're ready. We had a little break here, and now we're back in business. You had.
Other things that went on during my tenure with Homestake, which I don't know if I even need to say this, but. What a wonderful opportunity I've had, and so fortunate and so honored to have been able to represent a company over the years that I did. Should anybody be so lucky? at any rate, it's been wonderful. But that allowed me to do some other things that were industry related as opposed to company related.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the industry being the mining industry, but organizations that are outside of the company. And one of which was my association with the American Mining Congress, which is the industry's trade association here in the United States. It's an old organization that was founded back before the turn of the century, made up of the principal mining companies in the country, and its purpose was to affect to the extent the industry and its lobbyists could, to affect legislation and regulation of the industry domestically. when I joined Homesick, I had, before joining Homesick, I had been to American Congress, American Mining Congress meetings, which are held twice a year, one in Washington and then one in one of the other cities in the country generally associated with mining, be it Denver, San Francisco, sometimes Los Angeles, sometimes Chicago, but around the country. And at those meetings, the Mining Congress Governance Group meets, they have board of directors, they meet, as do committees of the Mining Congress meet on various issues. The Congress was set up with each industry having its own committee that looked at specific legislation and regulation that was specific to that industry. And then the committees would report to the board of directors as committee reports were formulated and policy and so forth for the board to approve or modify as they saw fit. So when I joined, before joining Homesick, I had been to Mining Congress meetings at various times, either to present papers or just to go and listen to papers being presented. Then when I joined Homesick, Paul Henshaw was a director of the American Mining Congress Board of Directors. And so I became his alternate to that. But more importantly, in this description that I'm giving now, more importantly, I became associated with the Uranium Policy Council, because Homesick Mining Company was in the uranium business. We mined and processed uranium ores. After joining Homesick and being introduced into the Uranium Policy Council of the Congress, I became chairman of that after the first year or so.
This was not a separate organization from the AMC.
No, it was a committee of the AMC. Mm-hmm. And this committee represented the uranium industry as one of the groups in the Mining Congress. And so I became chairman of the Uranium Policy Council. And it was during that time that we had some major issues. And this would have had to have been 83, 84, 85, that time frame. And the issues were centered around what kinds of regulations were going to be promulgated for the remediation of uranium mining and milling. What kinds of regulations were going to be imposed on the industry by the government, the various government agencies. And so we had had, the Uranium Policy Council had had lawsuits that it entered into on behalf of the industry going back quite a few years. And all of these lawsuits had been initiated under the name of the American Mining Congress. Well, by 85, the uranium business, this is post Three Mile Island now, uranium generally and nuclear power specifically, was really under a lot of pressure from environmentalists and other groups to cease. And so there was a lot of regulation and legislation that were being targeted at the industry. The board of directors of the Mining Congress, I think this must have been 85, the board of directors, because of Three Mile Island and other negative connotations deriving from the uranium industry, was sort of wanting to make that less, reduce the exposure of the Mining Congress to this very adverse publicity. And so they were, they had passed a resolution that any further uranium litigation that comes out of the Uranium Policy Council would have to be under other auspices than the American Mining Congress. In an effort for them to step away from this, they all the other industries had their own problems, and they didn't want this baggage. So the board of directors sent the policy council, the Uranium Policy Council members, and mind you, I didn't explain this, but all of the directors and all of the committee members were people who worked for companies. There was a staff of the American Mining Congress, but they were facilitators. All of the committee work was done by the companies themselves, with the American Mining Congress staff assisting and facilitating. They did not set any policy or do any of that. So these were all member companies, people that were talking back and forth with each other. The directors on the board and then the committee members were also company employees. And so we were talking to each other, but through this vehicle, the American Mining Congress. Well, when we were advised, we, the Uranium Policy Council, were advised that we were no longer going to be able to use the American Mining Congress mantle on these lawsuits, we immediately reacted unfavorably to that, because we had all this case history where the Mining Congress had been the vehicle through which we either made our petitions to agencies that were promulgating rules or to the government, the Congress, for enacting legislation. It was all done under the auspices of the American Mining Congress. And so we had all of this record with them doing it, and now they wanted to stop that. And we saw that as a terrible blow to the industry, being very obvious that the industry wanted to disavow itself of the uranium business and just leave us hanging out there. So we had a committee meeting, and the committee said, you know, this is awful. By this time, there weren't too many people in the uranium business. Kerr McGee and ourselves and just two or three others. There weren't a lot. But in any case, those of us that were there recognized that this would be a very difficult stigma for the industry. So I was asked to go petition the board of directors on this and persuade them not to do this. And so I agreed to do that. And so that was my first experience with the board of directors when I went to them at one of these meetings. I think it must have been 85. I made the case that of why that would not be wise, not only for the uranium industry, but for the mining industry. And lo and behold, I persuaded them. And so they reversed that. But the reason for bringing that up was, it was shortly after this meeting that I was called on the phone by one of the directors on the board. And the board, there were two groups on the board, really, an executive committee that did most of the work. And then there were another 30 or so directors as the greater body of board of directors, a total of maybe 40, but 10 of whom were on the executive committee that really ran the mining Congress. And so at any rate, it was shortly after this presentation that I got a call from one of the guys on the executive committee. It was George Monroe, who ran Phillips Dodge, and told me that the Congress is selecting a slate of officers for next year, and they wanted not only to elect me as a director, but elect me to the executive committee. Further, they wanted me to be the I'm trying to think of the title now. Finance director of the board.
So jumping right in at that level.
Yeah. And I think I had already been a director for 1 year. Mm. Yeah, I'd been a director for 1 year. Then made this presentation on behalf of the Uranium Council to the executive committee. That was it. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, so he was calling me to tell me that I had been elected. They would like me to stand as a director or of the executive committee, a member of the executive committee, and that I would be the finance director. And I can't remember if that's the right title, but that's close enough. And like any organization like this, there's a series of chairs you go through that then set you up to be the chairman at some future date. And so this finance director was the step before becoming chairman. So he said, we would like you to be the finance director. And I said, oh. He said, do you know what that means? And I said, well, I think I do. And he said, well, I'll tell you just so that you know what it means. You would serve for 1, 2, or 3 years, depending on how long the current chairman serves, as finance director, and then you would become chairman at the end of that. And I said, yeah, I thought that's what it meant. So at that point, they were electing Ralph Bailey, who was a coal guy that's been in our story earlier, as a guy that I knew and worked for. At Consolidation Coal Company. He was to become chairman, and I was to become his finance director. And so that did happen, and I was his finance director, the executive committee's finance director for 3 years. And that was 83 to 86. So I'm off a couple of years there. Must have been 82 I became a director, and then 83 became the executive committee and finance director. And then in 86, when Ralph stepped down as chairman, I became chairman of the Mining Congress. And it was at that exact time that Alan Overton, who had been the president and the paid administrator of the Mining Congress,
And he had been that for years, 20, more than 20 years probably, I can't remember how many, but a long time. And he was stepping down as president of the American Mining Congress. And so we had to hire a new person to do that. And so Ralph Bailey and I and a couple of the other directors were the committee that was going to select this person. And so we met for two or three times in 85 to interview people for this. Interviewed interesting people, and we were not in agreement, the four of us, on whom should be Alan's successor. one of the people I really liked was Ann McLaughlin, who had been Secretary of Labor under Reagan. And a very impressive woman, and I had gotten to know her a little bit in those earlier days. So anyhow, she interviewed for the job, and now she was out of office, so she would be available to take that job. But some of my male colleagues. In fact, I think the other three male colleagues were not in favor of that. Mm-hmm. But I thought that would have been an interesting thing. First of all, she's very capable to do it. Mm-hmm. But secondly, as a woman in a man's industry, and this is back in the mid-80s now, mm-hmm. she would have gotten attention that would have been far more favorable than anybody I could think of. As somebody that wanted to make a difference, come in and make a difference. But at any rate, I was not successful in pushing my preference on that. So at any rate, we did select a person, Jack Knievel, to be the new president of the Mining Congress. And so I started out my tenure as chairman with a new president who had come, he was a lawyer, come from a law firm, never done any of this before. So the two of us sort of groped our way down the hallways of Congress and so forth to press our issues. Thing that sort of compounded the problems in the situation was the fact that the mining industry in the mid-80s was really in the tank. It was only the year before, in 84, that the Business Week cover was a skull and crossbones and said the death of mining on the cover. And so here our industry was, Rust Belt, a polluter, a maimer of people, its workers all get hurt or killed, everything possibly bad that you can think of was all coming out at that time. So it was an interesting 3 years that I got the opportunity and the privilege of representing our industry during these times when it just seemed like every time something else came out, it was just more bad news. But we weathered our way through that, downsized the Mining Congress because our revenue from the member companies was diminishing as companies became less profitable and many were unprofitable. They dropped their dues and membership. So we were able to get through that in a fashion that that allowed us, as things picked up towards the end of the 80s, to get back in stride again and really led us to the point that I had tried to do, but was unsuccessful in combining the Coal Industry Association with the American Mining Congress into one association, eliminating a lot of the overhead and getting a larger dues structure so that the overhead we had would have more to work with. I talked several times with the fellow that was running the Bituminous Coal Operators Association about merging, and it just was unsuccessful in getting his ear. We were looking for our new president at the time, which I thought would make it really a good time to do that, because we didn't, at least one person wouldn't be fighting for his job, because we hadn't hired, early on, hadn't hired this person yet. And so I thought that would be a good opportunity to do that. But we were unsuccessful in doing that. And then it was, let's see, 89, it's about 4 years later that we got, the Mining Congress got around again to addressing that, and we did merge with the Bituminous Coal Operators Association and formed what is now called the National Mining Association, which is both coal and hard rock mining. And that has worked out very well. And like most things, it revolves around people. And the fellow that the Bituminous Coal Operators had just hired to replace their long-standing president, that fellow, Dick Lawson, who was a general in the Air Force, was doing a great job for them and has continued to do a great job for both the hard rock and coal industries. And so that's worked out very well. But that was an interesting time for me and allowed me the opportunity to meet a lot of people in our industry that I really wouldn't have otherwise had a chance to do. And so I felt that was very beneficial to me.
What were some of the principal legislative issues that you were addressing?
Probably the main one was the rewriting of the mining law.
So-called law of 1872, which has been rewritten 100 times.
That's right, but detractors were so clever in always getting everybody to put in the law of 1872. Because right away, the average person thinks, my God, how could that law be applicable today? So clever. Right? But as you know, it was amended 100 times. I used to like to tell the story about the farmer that had the same axe for 50 years. Two heads and three handles, but it's the same axe. Well, that's the way it is with the mining law. The argument that, well, you're only paying $250 an acre for the rental fee on this land. You want us to go to the government and say you want us to pay more? Why didn't the government tell us to pay more? We were never asked to pay any more. Who's ever going to go on a center of the rent increase? All of those arguments fall on deaf ears, but that was the main issue through all of this period of time, from 84 until today, really, because it's never been resolved yet. While I was chairman of the Mining Congress, I did make a plea to the executive committee that we seriously entertain writing a bill and taking it to Congress that would have us pay a royalty, which was one of the main issues on this, would have us pay more rent, and would solve some of the violations of intent of earlier laws, such as you or I or anyone can go stake a claim and hold it for $100 a year assessment and then build a cabin on it or do all kinds of things with it that were not intended. Let's propose remedial action that keeps that from happening. We don't, as an industry, we don't want it to happen. We don't do that. But people are, and so it's being thrown up in our face all the time that this law is not good for the country. And the reason I brought it to them was that our guy that did our government affairs stuff for us used to be the administrative assistant of Mo Udall.
Who was that?
It'll come to me.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, Bob Revelles.
Okay.
Bob Revelles.
Right.
He was Mo Udall's administrative assistant for years. Mm-hmm. And when I hired him, he had decided that he just had had enough of that. And we didn't have anybody. We had never had anybody like that. But we sure needed somebody like that. So Bob joined us and worked directly with me on all of this because I was chairman of the Mining Congress. So between the two of us, we had an audience just about any place we wanted one. But Bob had this relationship with Mo Udall. And Mo Udall is from Arizona. And his state is one of the big mining states in the country. The largest copper miner by far. And Mo agreed that he owed the copper industry something because they supported him through the years in Congress. And that if we wanted, and this is through Bob Revelles, that this all was able to come about, if we wanted, he would take our bill and sponsored in Congress. And of course, it was Democratic Congress, and he is a Democrat. And so I thought, well, all the years now I've been involved in the mining Congress, this has been hanging over our heads, and we just continued to lose ground on it. Here could be a chance to sort of seize the moment and get something passed. Sure, we don't want to pay a royalty. We don't want to pay more lease fees. But why don't we do it on our terms rather than on somebody else's terms and make it more like we do with each other? You got a claim that I like, I'll lease it from you and I'll pay your rent for it. We do it with ourselves. Why would we keep arguing with the government? We shouldn't do it with them. So took it to the executive committee, and they said, no. Boy, if you give in, then you're dead. Then you're dead. So was unable to persuade them to do that. But I still, to this day, think that we could have gotten that done and would have taken enough of the pressure off of the groups that were pushing it that it would have been very difficult for them to up the ante later by increasing the royalty rates and all of that. So that was...
better to compromise a little.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And we had this unique opportunity in that Mo Udall, who was progressively becoming more ill with his Parkinson's disease. Wasn't going to be around that long. And as a matter of fact, he only served one more term after that. So it just seemed like a window on time that if we could have agreed on that, would have really helped. But it didn't come about.
It's a shame.
Yeah, didn't come about. So I served as chairman of the Mining Congress from 86 to 89, which was, you can serve, we served annually, but we could only serve three terms by the bylaws, which is right. It shouldn't be any longer than that for any of us, just to keep new people coming in and new ideas and so forth. So from 86 to 89, I served as chairman, and because I was still 86 to 89, yeah, I was still active at Homestake for another 5 years, 6 years as chairman and CEO. I was still on the executive committee after that. Milt Ward took it for the next 3 years, and then Alan Bourne took it after Milt. But at any rate, I stayed on the executive committee until I retired, and then Jack became a director. And I don't think Jack's on the executive committee. When I retired, I really petitioned those guys, the directors, to put Jack on the executive committee, because I had been on the executive committee for 12 or 13 years by that time. So it's sort of nice to be in that inner group where you can affect more of the things that the organization works on. So that's until I retired, then I was a director, and then I was Jack's alternate after he took over for a year or so, and I am an honorary director. And of course, this now is the National Mining Association, because in 93 or 94, we merged that with the coal group. I guess one other thing, in 1990, I think it was, or 91, probably 91, maybe 92, the Mining Congress honored me by, recognized me as a distinguished member and gave me a trophy that stands about so high that I had the fun of giving to three